Welcome to episode 12. We're filming these all, in case you missed the beginning. We're live streaming all four episodes. We will then cut them up into the podcast, right, which is now only 30 minutes instead of an hour.
Right.
So welcome to episode 12. And the best part about episode 12 is we didn't have any technical glitches in the beginning of episode 12.
Wow, because it was already going on.
Because it was already happening, right? So what do we have for episode 12?
I think we're going to have to do science facts for episode
12. Science facts. We're doing science facts this time. Normally we would do science facts in the bottom half of an hour.
Right. But we'll do science facts.
There are a lot of great stories. And there's a reason why we do science facts. I'm going to tell everybody. We do them for a couple of reasons. Number one, we love to promote STEM. We love to promote STEM,
yes,
amongst people like doctors, scientists, geologists. We love to promote that stuff. And we love to promote people's interest in it, okay? Because everyone,
right,
always dismisses it as kind of like a dry whatever. It's actually very interesting.
And their understanding of it.
And their understanding of it.
Right.
But we also want to encourage writers to use some of the stories that we talk about and incorporate the science into their stories, and create more rigorous science fiction. We can't very well dog a book like we did in the last episode, or I did anyway,
yeah,
for not being science fiction enough if we don't help people out. So we have some stories.
Or defend it as I did.
Or defend it,
right,
as you did.
So
consummate writer.
Let's be, you know, we'll play good cop, bad cop.
Yes.
On that one.
Right. Ebony and Ivory. Good cop, bad cop. So,
that should be our theme song at the beginning.
No, it should be.
We get sued by a.
It should be Lethal Weapon,
yeah,
theme song.
Oh yeah, yeah. Our viewers,
okay,
are too young for that.
That's probably true. What's the first story?
Worms.
Man, I tripped out when I mean worms freaked me out. I used to,
yeah,
raise worms, by the way.
So here's the story. Do we have a thing for them to look at?
We do have...
Well, apparently the researchers found some worms in Siberia that had been frozen in permafrost for up to 42,000 years.
Yes.
And when they defrosted them, they started moving around and eating.
Yes.
Which means they had long-term cryobiosis. Up to 42,000 years ago. Just so you know... I believe that the current estimate for the beginning of behaviorally modern humans is something like 50 to 65 thousand years ago. So these worms are almost older than our species. Almost older than our species.
Yes.
Well, I mean, it depends, because some people would say that it's
at this level
anatomically modern humans, which,
right,
are much older. But I consider it to be behaviorally modern. So that's a crazy... these are now the oldest creatures,
yes,
on the planet.
Well, I mean, I thought sharks were like 60 million years.
Well, I mean, individual creatures.
Okay.
Individual creatures.
Oh, right. These...
Right. Those worms are now...
right.
Methuselas.
So after like 42,000...
Their trees aren't that old.
So after 42,000 years, they defrosted them and they came back alive. Which, by the way, is really creepy.
Yeah, the fact that they did live, and we were talking about earlier, they're like the... Now we're going to start talking about nematodes the way that we talk about tardigrades, which are also indestructible.
Yes.
And
before we move on to the next story, too, where you can finish this one, because we have a couple of people have joined us.
Oh, hello.
When you join, say hi. Just give us like a little thumbs up.
A little
hi.
Thumbs up. Say
really
hi.
Awesome. Or just troll us if you want. Anyway, we're talking about worms. This reminded me of The Thing, also. We talked about that.
Yes. The Thing, which was based on the...
A story by Robert Campbell.
Yep. About a creature that had been frozen in ice. It was an alien.
Yeah, but it was cool that, you know, if you were going to write a modern version of that, and there has been a modern version, which is awesome. A modern,
right,
like, on Clark's World is a story about the Thing.
But it was from the perspective of...
But it was, yes.
From the perspective of the monster.
But if you were to write a story about, like, humans that find an alien in the ice, you can use the technology, or you can use what they discovered about these worms,
right,
or tardigrades, to write a story about it.
There's plenty of stuff in the science story that you posted the thing. If you go to the website, or just if you just search for this, if you search for Siberian worms frozen in permafrost, you're going to find a story about this, and you'll read a little bit about the science, and that science will be able to, you can use that science to inform your,
yes,
writing if you're a sci-fi writer.
Exactly,
that's
fantastic.
The whole point.
So we've got another story, which is I believe we have something about spiders, don't we?
Let me see. If we do have something about spiders, it's not the one that I have up next, though.
Oh, what do you have?
I have fruit flies.
Okay, we'll do fruit flies then.
Okay. This one is mind-boggling.
Look at that. Fruit flies. Fruit fly species can learn each other's dialects.
Yes. Fruit flies communicate to each other by the way that they move their wings. Isn't that the way it was?
Yeah.
To warn each other of parasite wasps.
Yes.
That prey on these
colonies, these fruit flies.
Yeah, these fruit flies. And what they found was that different fruit fly species use different motions to indicate that there's a wasp in the area, which changes the other fly's behavior to avoid being parasitized by this wasp.
Yeah.
But fruit flies that have been in have been in contact with those of another species learn that species' language and start moving their wings that way, which means that that signal is, among fruit flies, a social construct, not something that's an innate instinct that they can't change.
Yes.
So that's an actual cultural, that's an example of culture in fruit flies.
And I think I think it says something evolutionarily about them, because we spoke about this earlier. One of the things that separates humans from other animals is not just language, it's complex language. The ability to communicate complex concepts and thoughts to one another quickly.
Right.
So, I'm not saying that fruit flies are all of a sudden going to start building cars.
No,
I'm
but
just
they
saying
are, they are definitely using a form of language that is learned.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, if you didn't want to call it language, you'd have to call it culture. Because if two species are using different signals and they interact with each other and they learn each other's signals, that's culture.
Yes.
That's what culture is.
And what is the insect, the person who studies insects?
An
entomologist?
I think it's an entomologist.
Entomologist? Like,
I don't know why I'm thinking that's wrong. But I
think it is wrong,
it's
too.
An entomologist.
But an entomologist could be like, I speak five fruit fly dialects.
Right.
Like, I not only speak English and French and Spanish, but five fruit fly dialects.
What I would like to see is a study, and I didn't see any indication to see how these fruit flies. Because I imagine they did this, but I didn't see the exact information. Like, if the same fruit fly who knew two or three dialects, watch them, how they behave. Do they ever accidentally speak the wrong language among... Like, if they go back among their own, if they accidentally speak the wrong... Like, you know, when I learned a couple of other languages, I would catch myself automatically...
Saying something.
Saying, like, I couldn't find my car in a parking lot. I'd be like, Buena Seara. And I'd be like, oh, wait, that's not the
right...
That's the wrong language.
I did that. When I came back from Japan, I would do the same thing. People would be, you know, would say something, and I'd be like, Nani?
Yeah.
That's not what you're supposed to say here.
Yeah.
So, okay, so that's a good story. I don't know exactly how
to take it. It's just like the ants being able to recognize themselves
right
in the mirror.
You're right. It does signify a level of consciousness and awareness that we wouldn't normally ascribe to insects.
To a fly. So now you got to feel bad killing flies now. Slowly picking off the animals we're allowed to be mean to.
Now, let's. Which one are we on to next?
The lake.
The lake?
Underground
lake found on Mars.
Yes, an underground reservoir 12 miles wide. If you don't know what 12 miles wide is, imagine the District of Columbia, and then that square that used to make up the district, if you can imagine this thing.
Yeah.
That's 10 miles to a side.
Okay.
So this reservoir is
bigger than
larger
DC.
Than D.C.
Yeah.
It's just insane. It's an incredible amount of
Well, why is it significant other than the fact that there's a subterranean?
Well, because it greatly increases the chance of there having been or being or
saltwater
supporting life in the future. Yeah.
So you have a 12-mile reservoir, which means that you could set up desalinators. So amongst the things that you sent to Mars, you could send desalinators to extract water, leave the salt behind. Salt would have other industrial uses.
Yeah, you could do things with that as well.
And you could I mean, the key to permanent life on Mars would be water.
That's one of the main keys.
And, it's like, yeah, so...
It would be... And the funny thing is the scientists here were saying that there's actually life in environments like this on Earth, so why wouldn't it be there? And the thing that really I got a little excited about, and this is my excited face, was that they said that there's no reason to believe that this is the only one. This is just the first one we found. So this may be the tip of the iceberg, no pun intended. And...
Hi there.
There's
water on Mars.
There is water on Mars.
Yeah.
They might find more. It may be, I mean, there's a very good chance this could be an average size one. And other ones could be larger, other ones could be smaller. And
that's the great part about it too. It's because I don't know anything about like you know chromatography or the gas chromatographs or like this the spectrographs they use to determine
right.
this kind of thing. I don't know if ice water would refract differently
yeah,
or
I'm
reflect
not sure
differently.
What, did they say that whether it was radar or what they used?
I don't know. I think it's some kind of like thermography.
Radar pulses.
Radar
pulses.
Okay.
The subsurface. So it's ground penetrating radar.
So I don't know how precise that is, but there could be other sources of liquid, but it might be in the form of ice. And the interesting thing about it is, we just found a 12-mile lake of it. There's got to be tons more.
Yeah, that would be weird if that were like the only.
It would be weird.
Underground water,
like a giant glacier that's under the underground.
That
yeah.
would just be so bizarre.
Yes.
And we were also talking about how this is one of those things that was very, very central to Kim Stanley Robinson's
yeah.
Mars trilogy.
He called it, man. That guy
and
nails
he
it.
Nailed
every
it.
Time.
He nailed it. Aren't they? Where are they in the process of adapting that for something?
All I know is I heard that they were adapting the Mars trilogy, Kim's the KSR, Kim Stanley Robinson's. I don't know at what point in the process. I think they're in pre-production. I'm not even sure if it's been, because they option stuff a lot, but they don't always make it into stuff. But it's being adapted, so.
Right.
So yeah, hopefully that'll come out soon, because I'm going to watch it.
Ballooning.
This story, I'm so conflicted about it.
What do you have to conflict? Well, here's the story.
It's a cool story, but
scientists have been wondering for a long time how spiders balloon. And when they say the word balloon, what they mean is, they let loose a thread, and the thread flies the spider off.
Yes.
I
posted something about this on
silk.
Fresh Pulp, but
right.
it was just about their sailing through the air.
Right,
about
right. just the fact of it. Well,
yeah.
apparently scientists were concerned for the longest time because aerodynamics alone didn't explain how the spiders got aloft. But what they found was that having a certain electric, you know, it's like a vertical electric field in the Earth's magnetic field was vertical, it would elicit this behavior in spiders. And the theory is that what spiders are doing is they're sensing these you know, electrical fields in a certain orientation. So they let out the silk, and the silk, something about the interaction between the silk and the electric field is what carries the spider into the air.
Now, did it say, because I read the article, and one of the things I was curious about, because I did some Google searches, was...
Right.
whether or not there is an electrostatic component, you know, because silk is
That's what they were thinking. Yeah, that's
silk is conductive.
Right, right, and that's what they're thinking is that there's something that the silk is interacting with it, maybe in conjunction with aerodynamic forces from breezes. But at the very least, there's no explanation for why the spiders would only start doing that when the electric field was in a certain orientation, unless it had, you know, it was facilitating.
Well, most people don't know this. As an example. Whenever you put a fan inside your computer, one of the reasons why you want to prevent the buildup of dust or particulate matter is
right.
because the air movement plus the particulate matter creates electrostatic currents.
Right, right.
So that could be something similar. It could be a combination of particulate matter and wind gusts, which create, you know...
Right, the wind brushing up against the silk would probably just make it even stronger.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Now, the other thing that I was curious about, because we talked about this also, was... this idea of magnetoreceptors in animals.
Hmm.
Because we've talked about, a few months ago, we talked about the Cry4 protein.
Right. In birds.
In birds. And I'm gonna relink my story that I wrote based on that. But birds have magnetoreceptors called Cry4 protein. It's Cry4 protein, and what it does is it allows them to navigate.
Right. It allows them to see magnetic fields
right.
with their eyes.
Their eyes. So... taking that same idea, it makes me wonder what kind of magnetoreceptors spiders have, or
yeah.
at least these particular spiders.
And if they use the same, because we do know, another story I should have probably, I don't know how old this story is, but I just saw it the other day. But that's similar to the fact that if spiders and birds have this same protein that's creating the same effect. I just read a thing the other day about octopus. They gave octopus ecstasy. And it made them more social, just like it does people. And so it's like, they already knew that octopus had...
There's something like really comical about that, though.
Yeah, it's like whose idea was that? Like the guy who came up with that idea was himself probably on ecstasy.
Right.
But,
the fact that they have a lot of the same,
you know, they have... Octopus make use of, like, estrogens and things like that. These building blocks are something that we share with creatures that have just been... overlooked for the longest time. Or is the one thing that keeps going around is that antidepressants work on lobsters too.
Well, it's sort of a, before you get into the next story, it's sort of a kind of gimme, because you know the idea of using electric currents and magnetic fields, whatever,
right.
to balloon. Because before they released this story, they thought that spiders were simply making these kind of parachute-like structures and
right.
simply just
right.
getting on these gusts. And in the video I post on the Facebook page, it shows the spiders like traveling these enormous distances.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, these spiders can literally land on you from anywhere and just bite you.
Oh yeah, one landed on the back of my neck the other day, and
that's
it was
crazy.
Just, there are always bugs.
I would flip.
Well, I've kind of trained myself not to do that. Like I just keep yourself calm, and I've taken it as kind of exposure therapy whenever something like that happens.
Exposure
just
therapy.
Like, get out of there, buddy.
So the idea that it's now there's an electromagnetic component to it
right.
is interesting because, I mean, think about that as a method of conveyance, or even really if you were going to write a story about, you know, parachuting into enemy
right.
territory.
On a planet
some
that
kind
has
of,
a high magnetic
yeah,
field.
Yeah, or even like a normal one, but they somehow figure out a way to manipulate the
right.
silk or whatever in their packs, or the packs are electroreceptive or magnetoreceptive. I think it'd be kind of cool. Anyway.
Right.
So we have one more science round.
Yeah, the last story is about Uranus. And it's, for the longest time, when we talked about, I corrected myself on Uranus about its axial tilt.
And its pronunciation.
Yes, and the pronunciation, Uranus. Which, I, you know what, I also posted on my blog one time that we should rename that damn planet. And because it's just such a ridiculous name. Even Uranus.
Who discovered it? Was it Copernicus who discovered Uranus? I mean, was that...
I don't...
Was the alternate pronunciation even, like... even in common English vernacular at that time, he was Polish. So,
well, I don't know, but I mean, alternate both the pronunciations, including the one I'm saying, it sound dirty.
That's
Uranus. And,
that's true. It does.
And so I just, and not only that, but it broke the rule. I mean, Uranus was a different, completely different generation than the others.
True.
So, and moreover, he was the god of the sky. You can't name a planet after a god of the whole sky.
Well,
that's dumb. I think they should have named it Minerva.
That would have been a good name.
Yeah, the rest of them are Roman name, or it's also a Greek god. I mean, that's the Roman version of the god's name. But
so, is there
Minerva.
Is there an Athena? There's no Athena.
There's a Pallas asteroid, but a lot of these names they use them because the Greeks themselves would give gods a billion different names.
Who's Zeus?
Rome,
I forget her name.
Hera.
Hera. Is there
a Juno? There's a
Juno and Hera. Okay, so
Juno is an asteroid, and
okay, so basically all the women are getting asteroids, and all the dudes are getting planets.
I think Minerva deserves to be
Minerva.
Yeah.
I'm partial to Athena.
Well, that's the Greek name, and all the rest of the planets have
what's the
Latin
is Minerva? Oh yeah, you're right, Minerva and Athena.
Yeah, it's the same.
Duh. Okay, I'm partial to either one, and let's just say, let's formally say it. Let's start a petition.
Yeah,
let's start
rename Uranus Minerva.
Uranus is it's a dumb name.
Yeah. And Minerva is an awesome goddess too. I mean,
it's awkward.
She needs more than just having this puny little asteroid named
yeah.
after one of her aspects in another. I mean, just no.
How
Why
many,
is there no Minerva?
And
it's just so bizarre.
And
she's
like nine moons, right?
What, Uranus? Yeah, it has quite a view. I'm just going to start calling it Minerva from now on. So Minerva. Let's just start pretending like this is true.
Let us know what you think, because we'll start a petition
yeah.
to have Uranus. It's awkward, dude. Okay, when you're having like polite, you know, science conversations at dinners, Uranus. I mean, come on. All right, Minerva. And besides, all of the female goddesses have got crappy asteroids. Let's
right.
give them a planet. Let's
right.
give them a couple
so what
planets.
Yeah, but the only ones, what? It's Venus, and that's it.
Let's bring Pluto back and call it something
yes.
besides Pluto.
Bring Pluto back. And, well, if you're going to bring Pluto, then you got Eris, and there are some goddesses to get back in that way. But
go.
look at the main planets. There's only, what, Venus? Venus is the only one that's got a...
That's
a goddess.
Yes.
And that's ridiculous. I mean, unless you count Ceres, which you could sort of, because it's round, it's a dwarf planet.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so I just
I'm
think
with that.
they're going to pick a god sorry. From a completely different... No.
Yes.
Uranus needs to go, and it needs to be Minerva.
Yeah. Needs to be
well, anyway, the science story about this is that the Uranus's axis is tilted almost 90 degrees, and they've wondered about it for a long time, like, what is going on here? And what they finally, what the researchers here, the Durham University
story.
In the UK, by the way, mate, that was terrible. That was terrible.
I know. I never know.
I don't know. They are saying now that it was because it had a collision, much like Earth did. A lot of people believe that the Earth's moon was the result of a collision. And you can see a good model of it there. I like that. I like those little slushy models that they show when they have planets crashing into each other and they do the...
Yes.
So that explains a lot about Uranus's evolution. And so it also says to me that, man, the solar system was a bad place to be for them.
Really volatile.
Lots of stuff, and I start to wonder about whether, because another thing is, I know that our solar system, a lot of these other solar systems are really, really tightly packed.
Yes.
And ours is not. We have a lot of space between our planets, and I'm wondering, what happened? Who hurt you, solar system?
Yes.
Did another star come through and just throw everybody all over the place and throw planets into each other?
Yes.
But poor Minerva, I'm speaking.
It's Minerva, people. It's Minerva. We're gonna rock it out.
They got hit at some point during its early. It also explains why it's so cold, because the distribution of matter at that point, and because Uranus is colder than Neptune, even though it's closer to the Sun,
mm-hmm.
and they're saying that this can be explained by the way that the matter was redistributed by this. Do what?
By the impact.
By the impact, and it therefore is not conveying the heat the same way that Neptune. Because Neptune is apparently Neptune got off easy. So, which is funny because Neptune himself was a god of earthquakes. But
it's funny because we always discuss these stories before we go on air, and there was a story. You sent me the links and we were preparing, and there was another story that we completely forgot about,
which was
the discovery of initial moons in Jupiter.
Oh, yeah, by accident.
By accident.
Yeah, they discovered, what was it, 12 or
12 20? New moons.
Yeah, 12 new moons around
I don't have an article, so there's not going to be a graphic. I'm sorry.
Right, but that was, they were looking into a part of the sky. What were they looking for? They were scanning something else, and they just happened to capture these moons.
Yeah, they count these things by the occlusion. So one of these planets will pass in front of the planet they're, like, and then they count and they go, oh, look, it's another moon. And apparently, I don't know how...
Didn't they find these by they were including stars that they were trying
stars,
to look at the background?
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, when Jupiter, like, moves in front of the Sun and they can see, things rotating. I don't know. Anyway.
But it was, one of them was retrograde. It had a record, like, all of them are going this way.
Right.
And there was one that's going that way, which that is probably an indication that these have a very violent origin.
Yes. But it also makes me wonder... And maybe I meant to do a little research on this and I kind of lost track of it, forgot. Is what method, like, are they using a different method now? Or are the telescopes more powerful? Like, what is it that, like, when was the last time they...
This to happen? I think all of the, these things, one just came online the other day that is going to be super powerful. I think that every single time one comes online, we've gotten to the point where it's not like waiting 15 years for better resolution. Every single time they put telescope online,
yeah.
It's just... madness how much better it is.
Yeah,
I mean, we're going to be peeking into people's pockets on another planet at any point. I mean, it's just...
You've heard it here, folks.
Yeah, I mean, people on Alpha Centauri are not going to have any privacy because of our telescope.
Yeah.
It's so crazy. They're taking
You're
going
to be sunbathing next to that Martian lake, right? And they're going to be taking pictures of you in your bathing suit.
They took a photograph of Neptune the other day from the Earth.
I saw that.
That looked like nothing that I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I can't even imagine... What we would have done 100 years ago with that technology. We would have just been out of our minds.
Yes. Well, we literally, most likely, we've driven...
More space. Than human beings are in general. So.
Okay.
That was fantastic.
Like a lot of stuff happened this last month.
Yeah.
The Martian Lake, obviously, was a huge deal. And I'm like...
Next
crazy.
Month promises, because we have the new telescope that came online looking for exoplanets, and... I have a feeling that something's going to surprise us.
I have a feeling too. So we're still getting great, great stuff back
from
all
the others,
the satellites, Kepler and Hubble and everything else. So, one thing before we go, because we're going to move into the next segment here in a few minutes. I did sign us up for, I signed Fresh Bubble up and I submitted both of our names, this is a surprise by the way, to actually witness a launch of one of the DSAT satellites at Vandenberg Air Force Base.
Oh, okay.
So what will happen is they're going to contact us and say, hey, we're going to reset your application. Like, they had an open application process. And I was like, why not? I would love to
cover
that.
We're live stream from there?
Yeah, we can live stream. We can use our, like, social media. Like, that's what they want.
See, I can wear regular shirts. That'll be, like, nerd cred confirmed.
So
I can get this tattoo removed.
So if we get it, if we get in there, it'll be really awesome. So let me see. I can't really read that from here, but it's Valerie Brooks. Hello, Valerie. Thank you for joining us. So I'm obligated to say thank you for tuning in.
Yes.
This is the end of episode
12.
Thank you for tuning in. We're going to continue live streaming the next two episodes.
Are we taking a pause in between 12 and 13 or no?
We can take a pause. We can pause.
Have a bathroom break or something.
Yeah, we're going to take a pause for like 5 minutes and come back. But before you go, I want to remind you that from last episode, we do have a loot crate. If you want to become eligible, like, share, comment on this live stream. Or any of the live streams that are recorded today.
How can you not want this?
How can you not want that?
This is a fantastic. It's a kind of a. It's a different material. It's very,
yeah.
Very
it's like a.
Smooth,
it's like a workout shirt. Good. I think you were running it.
Yeah, I'm not
cool
really sure what it is, but it does look like one of those sweat wicking shirts.
Yes.
Which,
if you
it's got. There's like the sun in the background. Yeah,
if you don't, if you also, you can support us by going to our Buy Me a Coffee page. The link is in all of our social medias: Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or you can do Patreon. Which is a little more, you know, it's a recurring payment. Anyway, do that. We will upgrade. We use it for loot crates. We'll use it for swag. We'll use it for everything. But
everything, every wondrous thing that you see.
Yes.
This
doesn't happen overnight, by the way. Anyway, so we'll be back in a couple minutes. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next episode.